Testing in the House Chamber, 116th Legislative Day.
The House will come to order. Members will take their seats. Visitors will retire from the chamber. The sergeant at arms will close the doors. Members and visitors are asked to please silence all electronic devices. This afternoon's prayer will be offered by Representative Speciale. We'd ask our members and our guests in the gallery to please stand for the prayer and remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance, which will follow the prayer. Representative Speciale.
Please pray with me. Almighty God, we thank you for this opportunity to serve you and to serve the people of North Carolina. We thank you for all that you've blessed us with, for we know that all blessings come from you. We pray that you will be with us during today's proceedings, that you will guide our discussions, that you will moderate our words, guide our decisions as we grapple with what needs to be done for the citizens of this great state. We pray that you will remove the divisions which separate us. We pray that you will remove the walls which we have fixed in our hearts. We pray that you will soften our hearts toward one another as only you can. And we pray that you will help us to accomplish what we were all sent here to do. We pray, Almighty God, that you will guide us in all that we do and all that we say, that our words and our actions would be for your glory. We pray these things in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The gentleman from Harnett, Representative Lewis, recognized for motion.
Mr. Speaker, the journal for August 19th has been examined and found to be correct. I move that it be approved as written.
Representative Lewis moves the journal for August 19th be approved as written. Those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The journal is approved as written. Ratification of bills and resolutions. The clerk will read.
The enrolling clerk reports the following bills duly ratified for presentation to the governor. House Bill 597, an act to make various changes to the statutes governing Wildlife Resources Commission. House Bill 604, an act to create a joint legislative study committee on small business retirement options.
Chapter bills will be noted. Representative Lewis recognized to send forth committee report. Clerk will read.
Representative Lewis, Rules, Calendar, Operations and House Committee Report. House Bill 370, Required Cooperation with ICE Detainers, favorable for concurrence.
Calendar, without objection, today's calendar. So ordered. Chair intends to move around the calendar. Rule 5, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair orders a suspension of Rule 12D. Members, the House will come to order. Chair intends to take up two bills that Chair believes may not be controversial. That's 554 and 99. And then to take up House Bill 370 next, and then given the amount of amendments, we'll take up the 559 after that. That's the intention of the chair at this time. So let's go ahead and get at it. House Bill 554, the clerk will read.
Representatives Bowles, Alexander, and Hunter, House Bill 554, a bill to be entitled an act to modify funeral services and crematory licensing practices, General Assembly of North Carolina Act.
Gentleman from Representative Bowles recognized to debate the bill. Strike that, recognized for a motion.
Motion to concur.
Gentleman's recognized, has moved to concur. The gentleman is recognized now to debate the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like the motion to concur. This bill has been worked out with all parties involved, and I ask for your support.
Further discussion, further debate. For what purpose? The gentleman from Nash, Representative Galliard, rise.
To debate the motion.
The gentleman has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's said that confession is bad for the reputation but good for the soul. And sometimes we debate bills that we're a little bit disconnected from. But this is one of those bills that all of us on the floor are directly involved with, because we're all going to die. Or we're all going to bury people that we really love. As a pastor, I've probably preached 2,400 funerals in the last 20 years, including standing over the casket of my own son, who is 27. And when we're making decisions about funeralizing people we love, one of the first questions we raise is, who has the remains? It's a question about who's going to be the last individuals that I'm going to trust my family members with. And what started out as a really good bill with great intentions, which was to correct some technical language, has morphed into a bill around provisional licensing in the funeral home industry. It is no question that we have problems with licensure in the funeral home industry. I struggle with the bill because, in as much as that we have a need for alternative pathways to licensure, I don't think this is the right pathway. The bill assumes that you can just exchange experience for education. It assumes that we can bypass certain aspects of education. We can bypass a person having been exposed to pathology, having been exposed to psychology of death and dying, having been exposed to funeral home law and ethics. The assumption is that we can bypass the education, and just because I look over your shoulder long enough watching you do it, it suddenly qualifies me to take an examination. You probably have never had this experience, but I've had it. I've had the experience of walking down an aisle, standing in front of a casket, when suddenly there is leakage from the embalming fluid. When that happens, the embalmer is not there in the room to help fix that problem. And some licensee who's just looking over someone's shoulder has no idea how to correct that problem. And it could be argued legitimately how often does that happen? It's not about how often it happens. It's about the fact that it does happen. For that family, when it's their son, their daughter, their husband, their wife, it happens 100% of the time. Because it happened that one time, it was their family member. And you need a trained person that can properly dispose of the remains of the people we love and care for the most. I think we, as a General Assembly, are setting a dangerous precedent when we start swapping out experience for education. I jotted down just the various areas that we have licensed people in our state. Electricians, plumbers, contractors, teachers, doctors, attorneys, accountants, cosmetologists, land surveyors, counselors. I don't want people that are building bridges and performing surgery and handling electric to think that they can do it as good as an educated person just because they've been watching somebody do it. I think this really sets a dangerous precedent. And I would just ask, are we really ready as a General Assembly to start turning professional licensure into who can take the best test? And that's really what this becomes about. And I would disagree with sponsors of this bill. Just before I came on the House floor, the North Carolina Funeral Directors Association, they do not support this bill. The Funeral Directors and Morticians Association of North Carolina do not support this bill. And quite frankly, the state board is just simply lukewarm and like, you know what, we'll take it, but we really don't want to. And they've said in an email to me today, we did not ask for this provisional licensure aspect of this bill. And so I would respectfully ask us to reconsider how we go about licensing in the state and not begin an unnecessary precedent. And let's find a better solution to licensing funeral directors in the state. I would ask that we not concur. Thank you.
For what purpose, John from Mecklenburg, Representative Alexander Ross.
To speak on the bill.
John's recognized.
Concurrence. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I must respectfully disagree with my colleague. I've been in the funeral industry for well over 30 years. When I was licensed, the requirement was 32 semester hours in college, and it didn't specify what you had to be majoring in. You just needed 32 semester hours. At the time that I started my apprenticeship, I had a master's degree in public administration, which is more than 32 semester hours. I took the apprenticeship that was prescribed, which incidentally is the same apprenticeship that is currently prescribed in state law and does not change at all by this particular measure. And I took an examination on the laws of the state of North Carolina because the funeral service laws in each state are somewhat different. That pretty much is what the provisional licensure section of this measure does. But the bill does some other things. One of the things that the bill does that I think is probably the most important thing deals with a problem that we have now concerning what happens when a person dies and they haven't seen a doctor for the last 3 months. Well, currently, a doctor can decide that they are not going to certify or sign the death certificate. And that creates a problem, especially when the medical examiner tells you, well, it's not a medical examiner's case. It's not the medical examiner's responsibility. It's the doctor's responsibility. And the doctor says, it's not my responsibility. And guess who's left holding the bag? And increasingly, we see this happening in the state. And so the bill has a solution for this by granting a limited grant of liability to a doctor who has actually seen someone but hasn't seen them within that last 3 months, and based upon their record decides that they can go ahead and sign a death certificate. As I said, that's one of the most important aspects of this. There are also about 30 or 40 folk who are out in limbo in terms of their licensure. Has nothing to do with the ability to pass an examination, but it does have something to do with the fact that our regulatory body went from a 5-year rule to allow a person to complete their apprenticeship and be able to take an exam within that 5-year arc to a 3-year rule. And there were a number of people who were left kind of out in limbo, and this does contain a correction for that. All in all, it's a very good bill. And I urge each and every one of you to vote for concurrence in this measure. Thank you.
What purpose, gentlemen, for more? Representative Bowles, rise.
Speak on the motion to concur.
Chairman's recognized. Debate the motion a second time.
Thank you. I am a member of the North Carolina Funeral Directors Association, and I did not receive an email this morning. But I did receive an email earlier when this was going to be voted on Monday night. And regarding to House Bill 554, following a lengthy but informative and productive conference call with members of the Funeral Directors and Morticians Association of North Carolina and North Carolina Funeral Service and the North Carolina Funeral Directors Association, as the bill stands now, it's something we can live with. And it was concurred that everybody had been consulted. Just like to clarify two issues. Number one, this, because you serve an apprenticeship does not give you the right to be licensed. You still will have to take an exam. And during that time of your apprenticeship, if the funeral director that is, that you're serving the apprenticeship under, same as any other professional license, does not feel that you will fit the bill, you can be terminated. And it's a matter of calling the state board and terminating the apprenticeship. There was a comment as far as embalming. This has nothing to do with the license of being an embalmer. This is only a license as far as it conducting the service, a funeral service. If that unfortunate situation occurred, as the representative, the Reverend, had spoke, the funeral director still technically could not do anything about it because he's not trained in that aspect of the funeral service. This is a compromise bill. It's been worked out with all parties, as indicated here in the email, and I ask for your concurrence on this, positive for a good vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
For what purpose, gentleman from Nash, Representative Galliard, rise?
To debate the motion a second time.
Gentleman's recognized. Debate the bill a second time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think the representative just proved my point about why this is not a good bill. The statement was made that those individuals going this path would still have to sit for an examination. Consider the logic of this. The current pathway is that you have to go through a certain number of credits specific to this industry, have basically experience in the field, and then sit for an exam. Under this bill, you get to bypass the education and still sit for the exam. The deeper issue in our state is that we are having a hard time getting enough people licensed in this industry. Think about this logically for a moment. If the current legislation or the current process or the current pathway says education and experience leads to licensure, how then do we wind up getting people licensed by bypassing education? We're in essence negating the entire Fayetteville Technical Community College program to say, you know what, you don't even need the education aspect, just get the experience. If that were the case, the current people are getting the experience and they're still not passing the exam. The deeper issue is we have licensure issues that need to be resolved by all the stakeholders. This bill does not accomplish that. We're not going to wind up with more licensed people. What we're going to wind up with are more people with provisional license who can't pass. They're going to do their damage for a couple years, and because they can't pass, they're going to cycle off, and the funeral homes are going to bring on the next group of people. Because you have to understand that when a funeral home has 3, 4, 5 funerals going on at one time, they need a licensed person in every one of those funerals. They can't make money without a licensed person in every one of those funerals. So how do I bypass that? Lessen the process, dilute the process so I can get provisional people in those funerals. It's still not going to mean we're going to wind up with more licensed people. It just simply means we're delaying the inevitable, which is fixing the bigger problem. We should bring all the stakeholders together and come up with a better solution. I ask that you vote not to concur.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Mecklenburg, Representative Alexander, rise?
To debate a second time.
Chairman's recognized.
Much has been made about education. Let's talk about education specifically for a minute. The bill does recognize education, so it's a misnomer to say that it does not. The implication is that there is something magical about some education at an institution in the state, Fayetteville Tech. If you are being licensed to be what is known as a funeral service licensee, and a funeral service licensee is a person who also will be involved in body preparation, then indeed you do need a specific type of education in order to be able to do that. But if what you are trying to do is to be a funeral director, you're basically involved in sales and service. You are not licensed currently to be able to handle the body preparation part of the business. So it's a misnomer that if you believe a funeral director on the basis of their license, capable of dealing with that. That's not what the law is now. That is not what the law would be once this measure was to be enacted. Most of us voted for something called 770, which was a bill that moved in all licensure categories, including some of those that were listed earlier, moved us in the direction of increasing apprenticeships to be able to deal with what is clearly a problem across a number of our professional fields, which is the availability of appropriately trained people. There's a lot of research out there that points to the fact that being trained in apprenticeships is an extremely good way for you to get both the academic side and the hands-on practical side of doing things. So to argue that a person who has gone through an apprenticeship successfully is not prepared to do a good job doesn't make a whole lot of sense on its face. Ladies and gentlemen, I urge you to join with me in voting to concur. Thank you.
Any other members dying to debate this bill? For what purpose the gentleman from Cumberland, Representative Floyd, rise?
Inquire the chair, Mr. Speaker, and also to ask the bill sponsor question.
Well, I tell you what, if you'll turn your light off, I'll take care of it. Question for the House is the adoption of the motion concur of the Senate committee substitute to House Bill 554. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will open the vote. Representative Morey, Representative Harris, the members wish to record. Clerk will light machine record the vote. 83 having voted in the affirmative and 31 in the negative. The House does concur with the Senate committee substitute to House Bill 664. Bill is ordered enrolled and sent to the governor. Let's see if I can find another non-controversial bill. House Bill 99, the clerk will read.
Representatives McNeil and Bowles, House Bill 99, a bill to be entitled Transfer ALE Move Boxing Advisory Commission, General Assembly of North Carolina Annexed.
Gentleman from Randolph, Representative McNeil, recognized for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adopt the conference report for House Bill 99.
The gentleman has moved that the House adopt the conference report to House Bill 99, and the gentleman has the floor to debate the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Really, there's only two changes in House Bill 99. One is the implementation date. It changes it to October the 1st, 2019, and that it also fixes a problem in the budget when the transfer of the Boxing Commission, ALE, was going to lose three positions, and this fixes that. So I'd appreciate your positive vote.
Further discussion, further debate. For what purpose does the lady from Durham, Representative Morey, rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To ask the bill sponsor a question.
Gentleman yield.
I do.
He yields.
Thank you. Representative McNeil, on the second page under the alcohol law enforcement agents, I notice under Section B, lines 40 and 41, is this adding new responsibilities or powers to the ALE agents to make arrests if offense happens in their presence and also assisting other law enforcement agents? Is it expanding their law enforcement authority?
Mr. Speaker.
The gentleman has the floor.
No, it actually restricts their jurisdiction because the old language was any criminal offense, which means they could do anything.
Thank you.
Further discussion, further debate, not the question for the House, is the adoption of the conference report to House Bill 99. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will open the vote. The clerk will lock the machine and record the vote. 115 having voted in the affirmative, none, the negative, the House does adopt the conference report to House Bill 99, and the Senate will be so notified. House Bill 370, the clerk will read.
Representatives Wayne Hall, Jones, Sain, and C. Smith. House Bill 370, a bill to be entitled an act to require compliance with immigration detainers and administrative warrants. General Assembly of North Carolina enacts.
Gentleman from Caldwell, Representative Hall, is recognized for a motion.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House do concur with the Senate committee substitute of House Bill 370.
The gentleman has moved that the House concur with the Senate committee substitute to House Bill 370, and the gentleman has the floor to debate the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, as you must be aware by now, there are a small number of sheriffs in North Carolina who have decided to stop cooperating and in many cases stop even communicating with federal immigration authorities regarding illegal aliens who have been charged with crimes in our state. The effect of these policies has been to allow dangerous people onto our streets. Just last week in Mecklenburg County, we saw an example of that when an illegal alien who had been charged with first-degree rape, two counts of indecent liberties with a child, was allowed to be released when the Mecklenburg sheriff refused to honor an ICE detainer or even notify ICE of the individual's release. Didn't even pick up the phone and say, hey, this individual is charged with serious crimes. We know there's an ICE detainer. We're going to release him. Didn't even do that. Oh. Of course, this person had also been previously deported in 2006. And then in May, as you probably saw and was widely reported, another illegal immigrant who had been previously deported was charged with assault on a female, communicating threats, felony larceny, and other charges. Yet he was allowed to walk out of the Mecklenburg County Jail one day after ICE had issued a detainer request to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff. And then 1 week later, the same person was arrested again after a nine-hour standoff with law enforcement. This time he'd been charged with domestic violence against the same victim as the first time, assault by strangulation, kidnapping, assault on a female, communicating threats, and violation of a domestic violence protective order. The bill before you today would put a stop to these policies in North Carolina. And the important thing to understand as we debate this bill is that it only applies to illegal immigrants who have been charged with crimes in North Carolina. Period. It codifies what almost every sheriff in this state is already doing. And that's why the North Carolina Sheriff's Association has endorsed this bill with what they call high priority, because they know what we know, and that is that a sheriff's job is to do everything that they possibly can to protect the citizens in their community. We worked with the Sheriff's Association and any sheriff that wanted to work with us. And so when the bill went to the Senate, we made a few changes. We'd heard over here that one concern some of these sheriffs had was that they wanted a judicial order. So we made a change to give them a judicial order. Essentially, this bill requires the sheriff, again, when somebody's been charged with a crime, they check their immigration status. If ICE says this person is an illegal alien and there's a detainer outstanding, the sheriff has to take that person before a magistrate, a third-party judicial official. And then that magistrate must put in that person's pretrial conditions of release that the ICE detainer be honored. So we've addressed that concern. We've addressed the concern of having a neutral third-party judicial official make this determination. The other thing that it's important to understand before you vote on this bill today is that ICE has a job to do under federal law. This bill doesn't exist in a vacuum, and frankly, whether we pass this bill or not, ICE is going to continue to do their job. But what they've done in the past, before a few sheriffs decided they were no longer going to cooperate with them, is they mainly focused on jails. They would focus on the criminal element of the illegal immigrant community. Not going out into communities necessarily, but focusing on jails. And of course, since these policies were implemented, we've seen the result. ICE has to go out into neighborhoods and into workplaces because they've got a duty under federal law. We are a nation of laws. We're a nation with a border, despite what some may wish. And ICE is going to continue to enforce those laws. They would like to do that inside of the jail in a controlled environment when they're targeting, again, the criminal element. But these sheriffs won't let them do that. And these sheriffs, in so doing, are putting partisan politics ahead of public safety. And there's simply no way around that. I've heard people say that this bill would hurt the relationship between the sheriff and the local immigrant communities. But the reality is, just like most people, those communities are not distinguishing between federal and state law enforcement officials. I've heard people say that, well, the citizens of these counties voted for these sheriffs. Shouldn't we just allow that to stand? But the reality is, these sheriffs campaigned mostly on 287G, not the extreme policy that we've seen since then, and just simply not even communicating with ICE at all. And even if that is what those folks in those counties want, that doesn't mean that the individuals being released are going to stay in those counties. They certainly don't respect national borders. How can we expect them to respect county borders? They're not. And so when the sheriff of Mecklenburg County or Wake County or whatever county it might be allows one of these individuals to leave, there's no guarantee that's where they're going to stay. And if you work in the court system much, you know that indeed they don't usually stay there. They're often never heard from again. And so when they're released from Mecklenburg, I don't know if they're going to come up to Caldwell County, an hour north, and hurt my family. Some of you live around some of these counties where the sheriffs are refusing to cooperate with ICE. You can't guarantee that these individuals are not going to come to your county. And so that's why we've got to have this bill. And in closing, I want to read a quote to you from one of our presidents. Over the past 6 years, deportations of criminals are up 80%. And that's why we're going to keep focusing enforcement resources on actual threats to our security. That's not President Trump. That's not either of the President Bushes. That's not President Reagan. That was President Barack Obama in November of 2014. And yet, just 5 years later, somehow, left-wing ideology dictates that we can't even deport illegal aliens who have been charged with crimes in our country. I would submit to you that if you're left of Barack Obama in North Carolina on the issue of illegal aliens being charged with crimes and being deported, you've probably gone too far. And if these sheriffs won't do all they can to protect the citizens of their county, they ought to resign. The citizens in this state deserve public safety. And if these sheriffs won't give it to them, we will through this bill. I encourage your support. Thank you.
For what purpose, lady from Durham, Representative Maury Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Please recognize the debate the bill, or the motion, rather.
Ladies and gentlemen, we heard the example in Mecklenburg County. That is an outlier of what we see in our courts. Over 54% of those that have been picked up on an ICE detainer have been picked up for a traffic violation, and they have no prior criminal record. One case I will never forget when I was presiding in the jail on a first appearance was a lady who was charged with no operator's license. Her car had been in a minor offense. She was the victim. They took her in because she didn't have an operator's license. She lived here for over 25 years. She couldn't get one because she didn't have a birth certificate here. Her 14-year-old daughter was in the back seat, her birthday. And at that time, we did notify ICE, and they did a hold on her. And that child never saw her mother again because she was accused of not having a driver's license. The vast majority of cases we're talking about are people with traffic violations that you're asking to be held, and people with no criminal records. The example in Mecklenburg County, what was the problem? Maybe the bond was too low. It wasn't about notifying ICE. That's a red herring. We ask our sheriffs, who are constitutionally elected, to keep our county safe, to patrol the streets, to do investigations, to serve domestic violence orders, to serve civil papers, to run and operate our jails. And now with this bill, we're also saying, why don't you take over a quasi-federal agency that has a $3 billion budget, and why don't you add to the duties we're already asking you to do? This is unnecessary. It is draconian and will affect and rip apart families across the state. Sheriffs do their responsibility, keeping their communities safe. Let's have ICE take care of what ICE is obligated to take care of with immigration issues. But to pass this bill is going to result in many lawsuits that are going to be paid by the taxpayers in their community. Let's work on this bill. If you're worried about the serious violent offenders, then let's tailor this bill to those people with those charges. But once a person has made bond, and once a person has served their sentence, to then say, oh, let's add on a couple days. It's not just a couple days. It's having people deported on minor or traffic violations that have been in our communities for years and years. I urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Mecklenburg, Representative Alexander Rice?
To debate the bill.
The gentleman has the floor.
Members, when Gary McFadden ran for sheriff of Mecklenburg County, he made it very clear what his position was on detainers. So I think the last time I looked, there was close to a million folks in Mecklenburg. Everybody knew what his position was. He didn't hide it under the table. So it's no surprise as to the fact that he has stayed very steadfast in his position. Now, there's been a lot of talk about somebody who got out of jail and should have been held, some folks say, on one of these detainers. The only problem with that is that that person had a bond, $100,000. And now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a humble undertaker. And I'm of the opinion, though, that once you pay that bond, the sheriff doesn't have any right to hold you in jail anymore. You're pretty much free to go. Now, I even though I play a lawyer on TV from time to time, I'm not one. I'm under the opinion that if you hold somebody like that you just may be violating their constitutional rights. And they have constitutional rights. And we have to be very careful about violating constitutional rights, because that opens up something you lawyers call a cause of action, I think. And that gets us into more and more litigation and gets us spending all kinds of money that we don't need to be spending, around, you know, these issues. Now, we did a little research, and Representative Autry can give you all the details that you need, but there's something that he said in discussing some research that just really stuck with me, and I wanted to share it with you. You know, we have an immigration court down in Mecklenburg. And in that immigration court recently, they deported about 4,500 people. And when they investigated and looked at how many of those people were desperados, the kind of folks that everybody is always talking about, you know, that you don't want in the country, you know, people with felony convictions, you know, bank robbers, criminal, you know, that kind of folk. Of that 4,000, there were 8 that fell into that category. 8. This measure is overkill. We are demanding of sheriffs, and you're creating a situation in it that if a sheriff does not abide by this particular measure, that is prima facie evidence that the sheriff can be removed from office. Constitutional officer, voted on by the people of their county, can be removed from office because they do not comply with essentially a voluntary program that generates an unfunded mandate that nets out of every 4,000 deportees, maybe 8 desperados. This makes no sense. I urge you to vote against it.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Richmond, Representative Brewer, rise?
To speak to the motion.
Gentleman has the floor.
You know, part of what's lost in this is this program that we're trying to get the sheriffs to do is that it is a voluntary program. It is not a requirement under federal law. It is a voluntary program. And why it is voluntary is these warrants are issued by law enforcement officers and not a magistrate or a federal judge. There's not one sheriff in the state that would not honor this if it was signed by a magistrate or a judge. And I think it's important that we remember that. We are asking our sheriffs to lock people up on the word of a law enforcement officer. There's no other provision in our law that does that. I prosecuted for 15 years, sat on the bench for 16. If someone from another state has committed a crime, a law enforcement officer could not call North Carolina and say, hold John Smith for a few days, we'll get you a warrant that's signed by a judge. You have to get that warrant first. You have to take it to a judge here and get a fugitive warrant in this state. That's how we need to address this. We need to set this up through Chapter 15A as a fugitive warrant based on what the federal government is asking. All they have to do, all the ICE agents have to do instead of them signing it, is walk down the hall to a magistrate or a United States District Court judge and get the warrant signed. I think this is going to potentially hold our sheriffs to violating the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution and under Article 1 of the North Carolina Constitution, Sections 19, 20, and 21.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Caldwell, Representative Hall, rise?
See if Representative Brewer would yield for a question.
Representative Brewer, gentlemen, yield for a question from Representative Hall?
Not at this time.
Doesn't this matter?
I will it shortly. Section 20 says general warrants are dangerous to liberty and shall not be granted. Dangerous to liberty. This doesn't even qualify as a general warrant. So I don't know how any sheriff doing this under North Carolina law will be protected if there's a lawsuit. Think about this situation. If a sheriff went to take somebody's guns for 48 hours because they felt they were a danger to the community, and kept those guns without a judicial official making any sort of determination, what would the reaction be? Somebody's liberty is just as important. And we need to respect that liberty because it's required under our constitutions, both in North Carolina and federally. We're locking people up without warrants. All you got to do is get the signature. It's not that hard. I've signed countless warrants over my time as a judge. Judges are pretty easy to find. ICE just has to want to go do it. And it's the reason I say all this is because of the removal part in Section 2. We're going to want to have a mechanism for removal for violating a specific offense in our state. Nowhere else, for no other office, does a violation of a specific offense warrant removal. And that's a problem for a lot of the sheriffs. I've got three sheriffs that have three different views, but the one thing they have in common is they don't like the removal provision of this statute. And removing them puts them in a terrible position. If this law is found to be unconstitutional in North Carolina, as it has been in other places, other communities have had to pay out legal fees for people being locked up under this. We're going to have the conundrum that sheriffs will face. If we lock someone up and it's found to be unconstitutional, they could face removal. If they don't lock someone up, they could face removal. It's a terrible position to put the sheriffs in until this is sorted out through the federal courts. Again, this is a voluntary program. It is not required. All they have to do is go down, get a warrant, just like we do from other states. I really think if we put this bill back into committee, get it into Chapter 15A, where if our local magistrates or judges use this as a determination of the conditions of release, we'll get to the result everybody wants in a way that is not going to end up with our sheriffs in court or this law being declared unconstitutional. And I'd be happy to yield to Representative Hall at this time.
Representative Hall, the gentleman has yielded to a question. If the gentleman still wishes to ask?
I do.
The gentleman does. The gentleman is recognized.
Thank you, Representative Brewer. Representative Brewer, I know you're aware of the individual in Mecklenburg County who I referenced earlier in my remarks, who was charged with first-degree rape and two counts of indecent liberties with a child and who was allowed to leave the Mecklenburg County Jail. My question for you is, do you think that it was proper for the Mecklenburg Sheriff to release that individual rather than hold him on an ICE detainer?
A magistrate or a judge of the state of North Carolina had set that individual's release. From what I understand about it, and all I know is what I see in the newspaper. I'm not familiar with the details. But a magistrate or a judge had set those conditions of release, and in order to the sheriff of what those conditions were, the sheriff followed those orders of release to the letter. When that person posted the bond in accordance with what was set by a judge, the sheriff did what the sheriff should do, is follow the law and follow the order that he was given by a judge. The sheriff had no other choice at this point. What was sent by the federal government was not signed by a federal judge or a federal magistrate. That's all ICE has to do. It's not that hard.
Follow up, Mr. Speaker.
Gentlemen, you? Representative Brewer here?
Absolutely.
again referencing the same individual in Mecklenburg County who was charged with first-degree rape and two counts of indecent liberties with a child. My question to you is, do you think that it was proper for the Mecklenburg County Sheriff to fail to even contact ICE, to let them know that the individual was going to be released from the jail so that they could be outside to detain the individual?
I don't think it's our place to tell the sheriffs, who are constitutionally elected officers, just like we are, on what they should do on a voluntary program. If this was a required program, I would share your outrage with this. If they disregarded a federal judge's order or a federal magistrate's lawful order, I would agree with you 100%, but that is not the case here.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Pender, Representative Smith, rise?
To debate the motion.
Chairman has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If a person violating the law by being in this country illegally is also wanted for ICE for other violations of the law, and then breaks yet another law in the neighborhood you and your family live in, it's past time for them to go. The sheriff should not open the door to the jail and allow them to walk out on your streets knowing ICE has placed a detainer on them for a legal deportation hearing. Those released may hang around, may go to another part of this state. They're still wanted by the federal government. And in some cases, as we know, they do violate the law again. If you're in a county jail and you are wanted on a violation of federal law by our U.S. government, you can bet your sweet bottom you'll be turned over as soon as you meet the local release requirements. Why then wouldn't some sheriffs turn over a non-citizen? Why should they be let go for continuously violating the law? Why are the crimes of non-citizens overlooked? I believe that's just wrong. We've heard some opponents of the bill say the legislature should not tell elected sheriffs what to do. As someone who served as an elected sheriff for 16 years, I can tell you the legislative branch of government made a whole lot of decisions for me. Through laws and administrative code, sheriffs are told what to do and how to do it all the time. There are constitutional, statutory, and judicial restraints on every aspect of a sheriff's duty. When it comes to jails, sheriffs are told how many square feet of cell space an inmate has to have. They're told how many times an hour the jail officer has to check on the inmate. They're told at what temperature the food for breakfast and dinner has to be served. Why then can a sheriff not be required to comply with a lawful request of a temporary hold on an individual wanted under legal authority by our federal government? Most sheriffs already do. Of course, I love the Office of Sheriff. I believe it's one of the greatest institutions that's set forth in our state constitution. But as our founders intended, this executive office is checked and balanced by the other two branches, including us. This bill does not target people solely because they are in this country illegally, and it does not force sheriffs to participate in federal programs such as that 287G. It merely requires a sheriff to treat an illegal alien inmate the same as they would treat you if you were wanted by the federal government. It will help keep our families safe by keeping illegal alien criminals off our streets, just as we keep U.S. citizen criminals off of our streets. It's just the right thing. I ask for your support.
For what purpose, gentleman from Mecklenburg, Representative Audrey Rice.
Debate the bill.
Gentleman has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know why we feel like we have to compel sheriff's offices in North Carolina to participate in a voluntary program that everybody's been talking about. And I'm sitting here looking at the Homeland Security website, and currently in North Carolina, there are four counties, Cabarrus, Gaston, Henderson, and Nash, that are currently participating in 287G. So if it's such a compelling issue regarding the safety of citizens of North Carolina, why aren't there more counties participating? Then we have the current situation of immigration court in Charlotte, which is the only immigration court in North Carolina. And as of June 2019, as my colleague, Representative Alexander, alluded, that there have been 4,244 cases. Of those cases, 4,182 have been ordered to be deported. And only 8 of those actually had criminal records or were deemed as national security threats. So I'm reminded of a quote by H.L. Mencken, a journalist who died in 1956, who said that the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. Thank you.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Chatham, Representative Reeves, rise?
To debate the motion.
The gentleman has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was, and I've heard a lot of the debate. What I'd ask everybody in here voting to do, first of all, is to try to ramp it down a little bit and look at what it is that we're actually trying to accomplish and solve. I think what happens far too often in this chamber is we get these one words that kind of get on top of everything that's on the bill, and then suddenly what we're debating really turns out to be our feelings on a particular issue and not really what the bill's about. I would ask that you vote against the bill, not because of, I think the quote that I heard earlier was a left-wing ideology. Though I do appreciate being continually stereotyped and grouped, I just say in this particular case, I actually have the ability to sometimes separate my own thoughts away from the groups that I get thrown into each time, even though it's a lot of fun. I just want to tell you that. But what I would say is that it's possible to disagree with this bill without being a left-wing ideologue. It's possible to vote for this bill without being a right-wing fill-in-the-blank, because I won't, because then somebody like taping me will say that I called all Republicans this or that. So, again, let's stop with the ideologies. Look at what the bill does. For the first time in 100 years, we are amending the removal statute. Now, I do like the fact that I've heard us discuss that we want to make sure that elected officials are doing their jobs and we want to be held more accountable. What I haven't seen in this bill is a removal statute for anybody in the General Assembly. And so I kind of struggle that the sheriffs now have the ability to be removed by simply someone coming in saying that they have not complied completely with the law. And I want you to think about that. Think about that in our positions. We try. I believe all of us try our best to comply with what we've been asked to do. But at times we may fall short. So the question is, do we feel good about a citizen coming in, filing a complaint, and then a judge saying, well, look, you didn't follow on this particular day. 364 days that year, you did a pretty darn good job. But on that 365th day, with no malice, with no bad intent, you did violate this, and so now you've got to be removed from office, ignoring what the thousands of people in your county who voted for you felt about you. We spent a lot of days up here trying to legislate Mecklenburg County. And in all due respect to all my friends from Mecklenburg, Mecklenburg can't legislate Mecklenburg County. But I've spent every year that I've been in office up here trying to legislate a local decision of Mecklenburg County. And I just really think we got better things to do. I think if you don't like something that's going on in the county, then you talk to that county's residents and they make a decision. Because in fairness, again, going back to us, because again, we're talking about an elected official, so I think it's good to compare it to us. How good would we feel if, let's say, somebody from Chapel Hill decided who was going to be representing Lincoln, we'd probably say, hey, wait a minute.
Mr. Speaker.
What purpose, John from Lincoln, Representative Sane Rice?
Ask the gentleman, would yield for a question?
I will for you.
I was going to say, when you invoke the county, you kind of walk into that.
I
kind
of walk into it.
I thank the gentleman for yielding, and I find it incredibly interesting, his example, that someone from Chapel Hill would try to come into Lincoln County and pick who would represent Lincoln County, because best I could tell last election, that's exactly what happened. So I appreciate the gentleman giving me the opportunity to bring that up to the people in this body.
That's pretty good. I didn't know anybody from Chapel Hill was voting in Lincoln County, so thank you for the correction. So bad Chapel Hill. Back to my original point. The bottom line is this. Voters can vote for who they want to vote for. They can ask for their laws to be enforced like they want to be enforced. They can ask for their sheriffs to try to enforce the laws to the best of their ability. But let me tell you what the General Assembly is not going to do. We're not going to provide more funds. We're not going to provide more support. We're not going to provide more bodies, but we're going to continue to tell them what they should or shouldn't be doing in their offices. This isn't about immigration. This is about the decision that we don't like something that one sheriff out of 100 counties did. And I think that's up to that county to make the decision if that's how they want the laws enforced. But law enforcement and immigration are incredibly complicated issues. And I would just say, when we vote today, remember what it is that we're telling people and what we're asking people to do. Secondly, one big issue that was coming up with this bill when it first came through has still not been addressed. What do we do about victims of crimes in these communities? Because what this bill is going to do is sentence them to no ability to have law enforcement. None. When they are victims of domestic violence, they have nobody to report to, because that sheriff now has to think about whether or not he's going to lose his job if he finds somebody undocumented who has been the victim of a crime and he doesn't go report them to ICE immediately. So do we want to condemn whole communities, whole families, to the ability in this country not to have the protections of our law enforcement? And I'm hoping everybody's answer to that is no, we don't want to have that happen. Well, this bill doesn't address that. And what happens when we do this is this doesn't stay a problem in a community of just people that you're thinking that you shouldn't consider. This goes throughout the communities. This goes throughout families. And we're not protecting them, and that's our job. So again, as was said earlier from Representative Alexander and Representative Brewer, the problem with the bill is that it's just a simple overreach for a problem that I'm not even real sure we ought to get involved in. Because according to everybody's statement, all of our sheriffs are doing what we want them to do. So just about all of the sheriffs are doing what we want them to do. Why are we trying to pass a bill that changes everything about how we approach this issue for maybe two or three sheriffs? And again, that's our interpretation about whether or not they're doing their jobs. With all due respect to the people who have talked about the one incident in Charlotte, I'm just like Judge Brewer. I've been in criminal defense and criminal prosecution and law enforcement for a long time. There's a whole lot more to that story. And it's not just that simple. And there are so many levels that have to be addressed before you start getting to whether or not there was an ICE detainer, how it was enforced, and things of that sort. So what I'm asking you to do is try to separate out your feelings. Try to stop figuring out what line you're supposed to be on based on the letter behind your name, your political party, what you've heard from people who actually don't understand what this bill is doing. Look at what the bill is doing and saying, are we truly, one, in an arena that we need to address? Two, if we are in an arena that we're supposed to address, is this the way to address it? And for me, just what it does to domestic violence victims, just what it does to crime victims of any sort, and just the sheriff's removal will be enough by itself for you to vote no. Again, if you want to address this, there are 100 other ways to address it, and I believe in letting the voters do that with our sheriffs, because their jobs are tough enough without us sitting on their shoulders telling them how to do it. Thank you.
For what purpose does the lady from Mecklenburg, Representative Cunningham, rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to pose two questions, possibly to Representative Smith or Representative Hall.
Which member do you want to address? I need to.
I can take Hall.
Representative Hall, is the gentleman yield?
If the member
sounds a little bit like a challenge there, but he yields to whatever that was.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The question is, was there a physical note attached to this bill?
Thank you for the question. And the answer to that question is no, because there's no fiscal impact. Nearly every sheriff in the state's already doing this. In fact, prior to December of 2018, all sheriffs were in some way cooperating with ICE. And again, I'll remind the representative that the North Carolina Sheriff's Association has endorsed this bill, high priority. They have no concerns about the cost, so we don't either.
Thank you. I would like to speak to the motion, Mr. Fisher.
Please recognize the debate to motion.
Thank you for that, Representative Hall. Only four counties right now are enacting the 287G. And from my understanding, if we do it, it's a voluntary program, it's not mandated. Each time one of the individuals come into the jail, the facility, then there's a cost incurred. Just like if you have someone on suicide watch, the deputy or whoever assigned has to go check that individual every 30 minutes. That's a cost. So it's no reimbursement from the federal level to any of these sheriffs that are operating under 287G. So they're providing additional services. So there has to be some type of incurred expense.
Just a
thank
moment.
You.
For what purpose the lady from Surrey, Representative Stevens, rise?
It's been a couple of times I've heard, it's point of order.
State of point of order.
A couple of times people have been talking about 287G, and have I missed something? Is 287G in this bill?
Well, it probably wouldn't be a point of order. It could be a question. The chair is under the opinion, though, that 287G is not referenced in the bill, but that would be a question, or point, I would say more of a topic of debate. For what purpose does the lady from Guilford, Representative Harrison, rise?
To debate the motion.
Lady has the floor to debate the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I don't want to repeat everything that's been said over this on our side of the aisle. I share all those concerns and more. We had a very healthy debate in Judiciary, I think it was back in March, and I don't want to repeat myself too much for those of you who weren't there for the debate. It's worth pointing out that we had a list of more than 21 organizations that were opposed to this bill. In addition to the six sheriffs from Wake, Mecklenburg, Durham, Guilford, Forsyth, and Buncombe, there are a number of organizations that are concerned about the issue that Representative Reeves brought up about victims, including the Justice Center, NC Child, NC Coalition Against Domestic Violence, NC Coalition Against Sexual Assault, NC Victims Assistance Network. They're all opposed to this bill, and they're opposed to it because of what Representative Reeves said. This undermines law enforcement's ability to keep our communities safe, and it will discourage witnesses from coming forward and will result in actually more crime in those immigrant communities. And for that reason alone, it's enough to be opposed to this bill. And that's why our law enforcement is opposed to this bill, and that's why the law enforcement and these other large counties that deal with these communities. For reasons unconstitutional, the cost to our local government, the impact on these victims, the fact that those who are sworn to enforce the law don't think this is a good move, I urge you to vote no. Thank you.
For what purpose does the lady from Wake, Representative Holly, rise?
Speak on the bill.
Ladies recognized.
I don't want to duplicate a lot what the people that have spoken here today. But I want to bring attention, you know, I've talked a lot about safety, and I'm very, very secure in knowing that our sheriffs work every day. But I have a concern about how you're going to implement this bill and the personal impact that it will have on people and their families and the discretion that is required in which to do so. For an example, I'm a person who looks like I could be a number of different things. You know, every time I go to the airport, I get frisked. You know, I have to say that I am racially profiled a lot, in a lot of different ways. I know that when I go to the hospital, I don't want them to say, do you have insurance if I'm critically ill? And if I don't have insurance, then say, well, I can't take you. I want the doctor to do what he can to save my life. I don't want our police to go to say, are you a citizen? Because if you aren't a citizen, I'm not going to protect you. Our sheriffs spend a lot of time protecting all the citizens that they're responsible for protecting. They police when it's necessary. Some of them, I think, over-police in a lot of ways. But I do believe that we need to look at this from the personal standpoint. To hold somebody for 48 hours because you can't get a driver's license or identification or verification of who they are. How are you going to discern who to hold and who not to hold without doing some kind of profiling? So we need to be very careful how we implement these bills. But I want our police and our sheriffs to protect all the citizens and let ICE do its job and not let our police departments get bogged down in paperwork, in jail time, because it is an expense. You got to feed them, especially if you're going to hold all these people for 48 hours. That's 2 days of feeding them, housing them, and the staffing that's required to do that. So all I say is let's look at the personal aspect and be very careful when we make these decisions, because I don't want to infringe wrongly on anybody's personal freedom. Thank you.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Forsyth, Representative Montgomery, rise?
Speak to the motion. The
gentleman's recognized.
Colleagues, I rise in this moment to hopefully bring light to another challenge with the bill as it exists. In particular, I have no disagreement with what's been stated in reference to the fact that I don't believe that anyone in this chamber wants individuals who have committed a crime not to face the justice that they need to face. The question is, how do we follow the Constitution as it is currently written and as we all have sworn to uphold? The challenge is that what this does is we have a challenge on two particular areas. One, a detainer is not, as it's been stated by Representative Brewer, it is not a warrant. A detainer is simply a request from an agency to hold an individual. That is all it is. It is a request that they be held. It is not a warrant that simply says that this person should be held based upon what a judge has stated. And based upon what Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia stated, stated very clearly that illegal aliens, in his words, have the right to constitutional protections in federal immigration proceedings. That is what he stated in his own words. And the reason that that matters is that if a person has committed a crime, we want to make sure that they face justice. The challenge is that many individuals who don't face justice are able to use the fact that they have not been given due process in order to not face the justice that they should face. And so what I'm saying to us today is that if we pass this as it stands, you are actually being counterintuitive for what you just say that you want to do, and that is to make sure that individuals who are criminals in our communities face justice. And that's not what we're giving them today.
What purpose, gentleman from Wake, Representative Jackson, rise?
To ask Representative Smith a question.
Representative Smith, do you yield for a question? Representative Carson Smith.
I do.
Thank you, Representative Smith. I believe you were a sheriff for a long period of time down in Pender County. And I heard Representative Hall say nothing was going to change, that these sheriffs were already doing this prior to last December. And I just ask you, when you were a sheriff and entertaining ICE detainers, did you ever, prior to the prisoner's release and after receipt of the detainer and administrative warrant, take the prisoner without unnecessary delay before a state judicial official who was provided with the detainer and administrative warrant or copy thereof? Did you do that in your office?
You may answer, Mr. John.
Did I do what this law is going to require to do if we pass it? No, it was not law. If there was somebody, an inmate in the jail, I had a release order that was signed by a North Carolina magistrate or signed by a judge that told me, the sheriff, what the terms were for this person could be released. It may be putting up a cash bond. It may be a certain time they have to stay in jail. So with that release order, that's what I abided by. That's what this is actually setting up for the situations we're talking about here. If you have someone who is here illegally, broken the law, ICE wants them, ICE has a detainer, then the sheriff, after this is passed, will take them to the magistrate and get the release order, giving them the ability to hold them up to 48 hours.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, ma'am, if I could.
You yield?
I do.
Member C.
And you would agree with me that that is taking an additional step by some sheriffs that they're not currently taking now, and that you, in a lot of jails in this state, you have to transfer the prisoner over to the magistrate's office to do this process. Is that correct?
Every county's different. I can tell you in my county, the magistrate's office was in the jail. So it was basically, you may have had to bring them from the cell to the magistrate, get the paper. If this passes, get the additional release order, and then they would be there for 48 hours until ICE had a chance to come pick them up.
Do you have an additional follow-up?
I do.
Do you still yield?
I do.
Did ICE always pick the prisoners up, or the chargees, whatever you want to refer to them as, within the 48-hour period?
I did not have a whole lot in Pender. There were sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. And if they were not there, then we did release them, because 48 hours is what they asked.
Follow-up.
Do you have an additional question?
I do.
See you.
If someone had been charged with child rape and assault and was a danger to the community, and there was an ICE detainer issued for that person, would it matter if ICE came and picked the person up in 48 hours? Wouldn't on hour 49 they still be a danger to the community?
Well, number one, if they were charged with something that serious and they were able to get released on the local confinement procedures, we got a problem locally. But I assume your question is, if this person were here illegally, wanted by ICE, they committed those awful crimes, and then somehow or another they were able to get out on the local requirements, then, and I think I don't understand the question. Madam Speaker,
would you like to
restate the question, and I'll finish the answer.
Would you like to restate the question?
I guess I could shorten it down a little bit, Representative Smith, and I have no problem if you want to yield to one of your other real sponsors asking this. I just wonder, what's magic about 48 hours? Why not 49 hours? Why not 72 hours? Or if these people are such a danger to our community, why don't we just hold them until ICE gets around to picking them up once they've had this judicial, because under your bill, they're going to be a new order by a magistrate that's going to say they're going to be held an additional. I just understand, where does 48 hours come from?
Madam Speaker, may I answer the first part and then yield to Representative Hall?
Representative Smith, you wish to answer.
You
may proceed. Representative Jackson, do you wish to propound a question to Representative Hall?
That'll be fine, Madam Speaker.
Representative Hall,
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'll try to answer your question as best as I can, Representative Jackson. The answer to that is that an ICE detainer is only good for 48 hours. That is the regulation from the federal government. That's the direction from the local sheriff. And the reason why, and I've spoken to the director of ICE for our region, they basically have a 100% rate within 48 hours. In fact, they usually pick an individual up in almost 90% of cases within 8 hours of being notified that the individual is in custody. And ultimately, it comes down to a question of federal law, and the federal law says through various cases, including the Arizona case, that local officials can do things at the direction of federal officials. And in this instance, ICE detainers are good for 48 hours, and that's why that time frame's on there.
Representative Jackson, do you wish additional follow-up?
I propose an additional question to Representative Hall.
Representative Hall, do you yield for additional questions?
Sure.
May respond.
Representative Hall, are you aware of courts across the United States that have awarded damages, civil damages, to people as a result of these ICE detainers?
I'm not aware of any courts that have any jurisdiction in North Carolina that have in any way invalidated ICE detainers. And in fact, most courts have not done so. It's only a small number of courts who have done that. And again, we can't lose sight of the fact that almost every sheriff in this state already cooperates with ICE detainers. And in fact, almost every sheriff in this country almost does this.
Representative Jackson, do you have additional questions?
I do.
Do you yield, Representative Hall?
I yield.
Representative Hall, are you aware of cases throughout these United States of America where U.S. citizens have been wrongfully detained under these ICE detainers.
The reality is, in any law enforcement situation, there's no perfection. However, ICE does a pretty good job overall, considering what they have to work with, including one of the major parties in this country trying to defund them. So I'd say they're doing a pretty good job.
Additional question?
Representative Hall, do you yield?
Absolutely.
On page 2 of your bill, line 18, that says, no state or local law enforcement officer or agency shall have criminal or civil liability for any action taken pursuant to an order issued under this section. You would agree with me that these officers and agencies are still, in fact, liable under federal law to be sued in federal court under Section 1981 civil rights actions, would you not?
Well, I'm going to ask you to clarify your question, but I'm going to try to answer what I think your question is, and then you can clarify it if I'm not answering that. No, under 1983, there's going to be no liability for honoring an ICE detainer. If that's the case, every sheriff in this state, or at least 90 or more, are going to have a real problem.
Representative Jackson.
If I could ask additional question.
Representative Hall, do you continue to yield? At some
Absolutely.
Point you can say no.
Why would I say no?
So we can be done.
I yield.
Representative Jackson, you may propound your question.
Is it your understanding that, in fact, there have not been civil judgments against sheriffs across this country for improper detainer orders that were recognized by the sheriffs, inmates were held, and inmates were awarded 1983 damages? Is your understanding that's never happened?
No, that's not what I said at all in my answer. What I said is my understanding, and it's not only my understanding. In fact, it's the case. That's never happened in North Carolina. No federal court that has any jurisdiction in North Carolina has ever decided that. And yes, I mean, there have been a small number of courts across this country who have made the decision that you're talking about. But the reality is, it's a very small number of courts.
Representative Jackson.
I believe he asked for Representative Smith to yield to him. So if I could ask an additional question from Representative
Hall. Absolutely. You?
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to go back to the section that I was talking with Representative Smith back on page 2, starting on line 1. You said that sheriffs were already complying with these ICE detainers. But, in fact, doesn't this bill now require something that of even the sheriffs who were agreeing and complying with ICE, that they now have an additional step to take an inmate in front of a judicial officer for this 48-hour order?
Every law enforcement officer, when they arrest someone for a crime, must take that individual before a third-party judicial official, and typically that's a magistrate in our state. So that's already happening. In this instance, and again, this is trying to address some of the folks on the other side's stated issues about the bill, we did add the requirement that when they bring them in and they find out there's an ICE detainer, then they'll take them back before the magistrate. In most counties, I would say, that is not an onerous thing at all to do. And as Representative Smith noted, in his county, the magistrate's office is actually just down the hall from the sheriff's office. And again, if that were going to be some issue for our sheriffs, I don't think that the North Carolina Sheriff's Association would endorse this bill with high priority. I trust the Sheriff's Association to tell me that that's not going to be something that's going to cost them a lot of money or cause them any problems. So I don't see it as being in any way an onerous extra step.
Aspect on the bill.
Representative Jackson, you have the floor to speak the bill.
So what you've heard is a lot of talking around the issue, but not really answering the question. So I'll just tell you, this envisions a second trip to the magistrate judge, and maybe this is not a big deal in Pender County. Might not be that many. It may not be. Now, this bill does make the change so that now it's going to apply to all criminal offenses. So while Sheriff Smith was maybe doing this for all, under the past law, it was only being done for felonies and specific impaired driving offenses. Now it's going to be everything. So if somebody presents without a driver's license, no operator's license, they're going to be taken downtown. They're going to have to go in front of a magistrate. They're going to get an order of release, $500 bond, unsecured, whatever. ICE will be notified. They get a detainer back. That person now has to go back in front of the magistrate. So to say that this bill has no fiscal cost is just unbelievable. Okay? Anybody who works in the courthouse knows that nothing happens without cost. And so now a sheriff's office in my county, it might be 100 inmates a day. In Mecklenburg County, it might be more than that. I don't know what it was. It was enough inmates in Mecklenburg County that ICE rented an office in the jail because they had to be there so much and doing all this. And so now you're going to have to do this in front of a magistrate. A magistrate's going to see an extra 100 cases a day. To say that has no fiscal cost is just beyond me. This was a bad bill the first time it came to us. The Senate took it. They made it a little better in some ways. They made it a little worse. It's still a bad idea. I'd ask you to vote no.
Well, for purposes of the gentleman from Brunswick, Representative Fowler, arise.
To very briefly debate the motion.
You have the floor to very briefly debate the motion.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I want you to hear from a non-attorney a couple of seconds. When debate gets far afield, sometimes I pull out my North Carolina Constitution and take a look at it. And Article 7, Section 1 begins, and this is very brief, the General Assembly shall, not may, provide for the organization and government and the fixing of boundaries of counties, the organization and government and fixing of boundaries of counties, cities, and towns, and other governmental subdivisions, and except as otherwise provided in this Constitution, may give such powers and duties to counties, cities, and towns, and other governmental subdivisions as it may deem advisable. So, yes, in context of all what you heard, particularly referring to the sheriff, they are independently elected, but we have the obligation to help, we shall provide for the organization and government and fixing of boundaries of counties. So context, everything you've heard, we do have an obligation to do what we're doing here and to protect the citizens. They're the citizens of the county, citizens that have voted for that sheriff, and there are citizens of this body of 120 here today. Thank you.
For what purpose is Representative from Wake, Representative Dowell, seek recognition?
To speak on the bill.
You have the floor to speak on the motion to concur.
I'll speak on the motion. So I have a concern, and I don't know if any of you have ever been through the immigration system, but my wife is an immigrant, and I've had the pleasure of our federal immigration system. It is a long and arduous process. It is not clear. We actually had to hire a lawyer to go through that service, and we're both college educated. I believe that we should be able to follow through. But one of the issues that nobody's really talking about is sometimes things get sent in the mail and not caught up in the computers. So this bill would actually have sent my now wife back to England when her green card didn't come for 3 weeks, because she would have then been an illegal, but she wasn't illegal because she was in process. And there could have been an ICE detainer put out on her because she was still in process. So this doesn't alleviate some of the issues. So if someone is legally here, but they're in process and the federal government hasn't caught up, then they would be sent home. So I'm really confused as how we're going to handle that, because the federal system is a very slow system. I'm also concerned about victims. I'm concerned about men and women who have had crimes perpetrated against them. And then they don't get justice. So we're helping people circumvent our law. We're helping people get away from crimes. This is a real concern for me. It's a real concern for those people that I care about, that I know have been had crimes perpetrated against them, sexual crimes, assault, and we're now going to help them get away with that crime. Because when they go back, they're not going to be sentenced to anything. So if it's to get the criminals, then we need to get the criminals. We don't need to just send somebody back with no operator's license because they're here. So I'm really concerned, and I'll be a no vote.
What purpose is the gentleman from Columbus, Representative Jones, rise?
To debate the motion.
You have the floor to debate the motion.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and I hope this statement will help clear up some things for you folks. This bill applies to illegal immigrants in the custody of officers and charged with a crime. I have heard that rabbit chased on the other side till that rabbit is dead about things that this bill has nothing to do with. This is requiring sheriffs who took an oath to do their job. If it was a bad idea when we were in committee, we'd have had 95 sheriffs in there, not four. The sheriffs agree that it's a good idea. The Sheriff's Association agrees that it's a good idea. If it's good enough for the citizen of North Carolina to have to uphold these laws, it should be good enough for one that could possibly have a detainer on them. These are criminals. This is not targeting anybody. This is about someone who has been arrested that is a criminal. I have some great guys on this bill. Great legal mind, you've heard him. If you agree with him or not, great legal mind. Former sheriff, senior member. And I'm just a citizen. But a concerned one. By putting my name on this bill and hopefully getting into law, that it keeps one person from being assaulted again, one person from maybe being murdered, or one person from being raped because we inconvenienced a criminal for 48 hours, I'll take that.
Members, I show only one speaker remaining, and that intends to be the last person I call unless your lights come on now. For what purpose does the lady from Pitt, Representative Smith, rise? She passes off. For what purpose does the lady from Durham, Representative Moore, rise?
Thank you, Desk. Representative Hastings, a question?
Representative?
I'm sorry, Representative Jones.
Representative Jones, do you yield for a question?
I do. Yes, ma'am.
Listening to your remarks just now, do you really believe all people in jail are criminals?
No. May I follow up?
Well, you may respond to the question.
I do not believe that everyone in jail is a criminal, just like I don't believe everybody in a store is a shoplifter. But I also heard in this chamber just a little while ago that we want to say that crimes, some are not really crimes. We shouldn't punish people for certain crimes, and that's disturbing to me.
The lady...
I'd like to speak briefly a second time.
Second time? You have the floor to speak a second time, and this will be the... We have one after this, final speaker.
Thank you. Members, I stand because many of the remarks are saying people in jail are criminals. And we're talking about constitutional rights. Don't forget there is a presumption of innocence until someone is convicted of a crime and maybe given a prison sentence. But to keep referring to people in jail as criminals is against every fiber of what we believe in the presumption of innocence, and I hope we remember that. Thank you.
The gentleman from Cleveland, Speaker Moore, is recognized to be our final speaker.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Just a few remarks about this bill. This is, and again, I don't debate often, but this is one that I debated when we took it up before in the House and that I feel compelled to speak to today. I just happened to be in Charlotte the other day when the news came out about the fellow being released who had been accused with rape and apparently had a long criminal history, and I was just shocked by it. And then I've had some to say, well, why do you worry about what happens in another county? Well, because, you know, for example, Mecklenburg County, it's our largest county in the state. Many people in my district work in Mecklenburg County. I'm there all the time. I was there representing a client that day. And it is, in these large counties of our state, just I think now five counties, to have sheriffs who think that it is a good policy for some political reason to release dangerous criminals on the street to let folks out, folks who are accused of rape. Okay, it's a little more serious than a parking ticket. I mean, these are folks accused with rape, other serious crimes, to release them out and not honor those ICE detainers does not make sense.
And there comes a time when even someone who's politically elected, like these sheriffs, should be able to put aside politics and do what's right for the public safety. And as I've sat down and tried to rationalize, it doesn't make sense. I mean, my two teenage sons looked at it and thought, that doesn't make any sense. I have yet to run into anybody that I'm talking to on the street or back home that thinks that that's a good idea to release someone accused of rape and not turn them over to Immigration's Customs Enforcement officials when there's a detainer. So what is a detainer? So a detainer does not apply to simply anyone who is here under illegal or questionable immigration status. A detainer is issued by ICE when it is someone who is in custody for a crime and who has, and they have probable cause to believe this person is dangerous, that they have committed other crimes or shown a propensity to commit crimes to be dangerous. Now, we've seen examples of where gang members have come across the border and got and committed all sorts of crimes. That's where a lot of this got started at some point. But then the realization that making sure that if there's someone here illegally who is in custody and has committed a crime, that they should be held until they can be turned over to ICE officials. Now, there is a separate process it goes through to ensure that their rights are safeguarded. So as an attorney, absolutely, everyone who is taken into custody by the government is entitled to rights. They're entitled to rights to counsel. They're entitled to other constitutional rights that anyone should have if they're taken into custody. Our government must always be checked on that. But this is a common sense provision, allows 48 hours. You can look at a couple of the judges who've spoken. We can name several examples of where individuals under our state courts, people who are citizens, can be held for up to 48 hours without a bond being set. Look at chapter 50B. There are several examples of that. So 48 hours has been recognized by the courts as not too unreasonable of a burden to give time for law enforcement to execute the process, to take that person to custody, to then get that individual before whatever the next level is. If they're taken into federal custody, to go before a federal magistrate, to go before the immigration court. But as a state that wants to uphold laws, that wants to protect our citizens, it only makes sense. Now, I mentioned those who said they were concerned about victims of crime. I do think we need to make sure that someone who is here, regardless of their immigration status, should feel comfortable reporting to law enforcement if they're a victim of crime. Absolutely. But you know, some of these individuals who've been taken into custody, some of these individuals who've been turned loose by some of these sheriffs, have committed crimes against members of that very population. They've committed crimes against other individuals who maybe they shouldn't be here legally, but guess what? They deserve the rights and protection of laws as well. And they deserve to know that someone who has hurt them, who has injured them, someone who has tried to rape them, is not just going to be turned loose back out on the street. And I want to back up what Representative Smith said. Look, if we've got a situation where folks think it's okay to release somebody charged with a violent rape back on the street, we've got even bigger problems. That shouldn't be happening. That should not be happening. So this bill strikes a balance. It strikes a balance between protecting the presumption of innocence, guaranteeing that someone can get in front of a judicial official for a hearing without unnecessary delay, and at the same time ensuring that someone who is here illegally and is dangerous and is being held for a criminal offense can be reported to the proper Immigration and Customs Enforcement to be turned over to ensure that that everyone is protected. My friends, that is all this bill does. It is not a broader debate on immigration. That is a federal issue. It's not a debate on other matters. It's simply a debate on whether you believe that you, your friends, your neighbors, and every citizen and every person in this state, regardless of their citizenship, deserves to be protected from violence being committed against them. This is a good common sense bill. I hope you'll support it.
Madam Speaker.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Wake seek recognition?
Ask Speaker Moore a question.
Speaker Moore, do you yield for a question?
Yes.
Mr. Speaker, with all due respect, you said it twice in your comments about these detainers and only for violent criminals. But isn't it in fact correct that in March of 2017, ICE changed their detainer forms? They moved from form number 274 to 270A and no longer is criminal record or danger to society or any of those other things it required for an ICE detainer, and now only thing is required is a final order of removal?
I think if you'll see, if you'll look at the information that ICE has put out, they very clearly said they are looking at folks who are here who have committed crimes and who pose a danger. In fact, the situation in Charlotte just the other day, the U.S. Attorney's Office and ICE released a statement talking about how this was an example of a violent person being turned back out on the street. Look, they don't have the resources to be out trying to enforce all of this. If you look at the individuals where this has been an issue, it's been where folks have been arrested, charged with a crime, not just a traffic ticket. You and I both know as attorneys, someone goes out and commits a motor vehicle offense, unless it's a DWI or something, generally they're going to get a ticket, they're going to get a criminal summons, they're going to go on their way. These are for serious offenses where they're actually being taken into custody, processed, and being assigned either some kind of bond in that case. And in those cases, all this bill says is that sheriffs are subject to removal if they refuse to cooperate with ICE when there's an ICE detainer. So let's look at the practical application. The person's coming in. If they're coming in on some minor little misdemeanor, they're going to go in front of a magistrate, probably get some small bond and go out the door. There's not even going to be ICE involvement. ICE involvement comes when it's a serious crime. Domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, robbery with a dangerous weapon. Go on and on and on those things where someone actually has to post a secured bond, is taken into custody, and then activates the process where ICE is activated. So let's don't fool ourselves. I don't care what the form says. Look at the application of what happens. That's exactly how that happens. And I think as a fellow attorney, you would have to acknowledge that's generally how that works. Folks are being held in those kind of cases with secured bonds, or it would trigger it on serious offenses.
Question before the House. Is the motion to concur in House Bill 370 conference report? Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will open the vote. Representative Jarvis, does the man wish to record? Does the man wish to record? The clerk will lock and record the vote. 62 having voted in the affirmative, 53 in the negative. The motion to concur passes and will be engrossed and sent to the governor by special messenger. Senate Bill 559, the clerk will read.
Senators Rabin, Heiss, and Blue. Senate Bill 559, a bill to be entitled an act to permit financing of certain storm recovery costs and to authorize the Utilities Commission to fix rates of electronic public utilities using multi-year plan rates and banding authority return merchant mechanisms. General Senator North Carolina and Act.
Jump from Harnett, Representative Lewis, recognize, debate the bill on second reading.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, I also want to thank you for doing all the non-controversial bills first before we got to this one.
You're welcome.
Very helpful. Mr. Speaker, this past weekend I had the privilege of taking my son to college to begin his freshman year. It was a bittersweet time with our family. There were a lot of parting words, last-minute words of wisdom to sort of fill the space and the time as my wife and I and my little girl prepared to leave. One of the things that we had said to him was, please make good decisions when you're there. And that leads to a natural question. You know, what are good decisions? And I tried to offer some advice to that end as well. First of all, think for yourself. Make your own decisions. Thoughtfully investigate what you hear. Don't compromise your convictions for the sake of what is easy or just to keep the peace. Identify groupthink and possible bias, and instead be the one that is fair and open-minded. Ask yourself why someone is against what you believe is right. don't buckle to pressure, fear, or guilt, but have courage and conviction to do the right thing. In the final weeks of summer that we've spent together here, he couldn't help but notice my face and head plastered on the back of several North Carolina newspapers to attack his dad for allegedly supporting automatic rate hikes and other blatant mischaracterizations about this bill and about its sponsors. That was not easy for him. No one wants to see their mother or father treated like that. But at least it gave me an opportunity to impress upon him my advice of doing what is right, no matter what someone tries to do to you. A lot has been said about Senate Bill 559, but let me cut through the noise and remind everyone what Senate Bill 559 is. Senate Bill 559 is a bipartisan, permissive bill, a bill that gives the North Carolina Utility Commission the ability to use new tools if the North Carolina Utility Commission decides to use them, securitization to save utility customers money on their monthly bills for storm cost, and multi-year rate plans that provides the utility the opportunity to reach consensus with stakeholders about capital investment to meet North Carolina's clean energy future and propose those to the North Carolina Utilities Commission. A bill to allow customer savings and consensus with stakeholders about smart investments. That's it. That's all. A bill where all the power remains vested with the North Carolina Utilities Commission, as it has been for over 100 years, a commission tasked with deciding what is best for the customer. A bill where the North Carolina Utilities Commission decides or directs either tool should be used to the benefit of the customer and not the utility. Securitization, in layman's terms, is where the North Carolina Utilities Commission can decide if $700 million in storm recovery costs incurred to repower the state after the devastation caused by Hurricane Matthew and Florence can be restructured where a third-party debtor issues bond for the debt with a lower interest rate, allowing the customer to pay the debt back to the debtor over time at a lower interest rate. The utility forgoes a return in exchange for recovering its money up front. A tool estimated to allow customers to save 15 to 20% on their monthly electric bills. This is a win-win. The multi-year rate plan. What is a multi-year rate plan? It's where, for the first time in over 100 years, the North Carolina Utilities Commission can consider whether it makes sense to consider analyzing utility capital investments 3 years at a time instead of looking back 1 year at a time after the utility has already spent the money. Is the three-year proposal beneficial to the customer? Is it least cost? Is it prudent? That's up to the utilities commission to decide, as it always has been. Those of us in this chamber who operate businesses understand that planning in advance, being able to consider hiring needs, purchasing needs, economies of scale, help the business save money and help the end user with a better price. The Utilities Commission is empowered to compare a proposed multi-year rate plan with a traditional rate case and decide what's better for the customer side by side. The proposal under the multi-year rate plan can only apply to capital investments. And I might add that 35 other states have adopted multi-year rate plan as a model. Again, both of these are permissive tools, only used if the regulator, the utility commission, says it's best. So, why have we received emails and robocalls asking us to vote against this bill? Why have some groups perpetuated the myth that Senate Bill 559 raises rates or allows the big utility some type of unfair advantage or home or harms consumers? Early on, the bill sponsors met with customers and business stakeholders to address these concerns. Guardrails have been inserted into the bill. One concern was that the utility could manipulate the ROE band in the bill and milk profits from customers. In fact, we changed the bill to ensure that earnings between the middle earnings band and the top of the earnings band were earmarked to be reinvested in economically distressed community, including affordable housing. Earnings above the top of the band are to be returned to customers. You'd think that both of these conditions would have appeased any opponents and shown that this bill is really about the policy of a new permissive tool that the North Carolina Utilities Commission may consider and nothing else. No, certain opponents could not be pacified, and I believe never will be pacified until their list of demands can be added to the bill that benefits them and not the customers. Most of these opponents have been happy to attack members of this body every 2 years, regardless of what we do. They've resorted to fear-mongering and have mischaracterized this bill in hopes of extracting X, Y, or Z from the utility in return for its passing. More of this or more of that, regardless of the customer rates. Opponents of this bill are doing the exact thing they accuse this bill of and supposedly and incorrectly doing, which is automatically adding things to our energy future for the customer to pay for. We shouldn't be in the business of deciding what our energy future looks like by guaranteeing gives in exchange for policy. Our utilities, our stakeholders, and the academic team at the Utilities Commission should be deciding that. Let's make a good decision today, folks. Let's vote for this good, permissive bill. Let's put these tools in place that are good for the consumer. I respectfully ask for your green vote on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
For what purpose, gentlemen from Cumberland, Representative Lucas Rice?
To briefly debate the bill.
Gentleman has four.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 559 has come a long way on a journey, and as we have perused this journey, it's taken many side journeys, some of them positive, some negative. The original intent was to lend assistance to those who have experienced calamities through storms. And I think Part 1 does that, continuously does that very well. Hopefully you like that. Part 2 is where we've got nasty the waters. Many folk have taken the position that Part 2 tends to be, in places, something that doesn't make sense. You've heard that from previous bills. It doesn't make sense. I would remind you that making sense depends upon those who are deciding what's sensible. Think about it. It makes sense to plan for the future. So Part 2 of this does do that. We attempt to plan the future. Now, just so happens that there's a big utility that's helping to plan for that future. Maybe that's part of the resentment. I don't know. But I would share with you that this bill has continuously had bipartisan support. Over in the Senate, it passed on a bipartisan basis, and it's had bipartisan support over in the House here. And we hopefully will pass it in the House on a bipartisan basis. I would say it's a good bill. It's not a perfect bill. Yes, there's a lot to be desired that we could change and we could improve. But as with most bills, I don't know of any perfect bill, but this bill is good enough to pass. Please support it.
For our purpose, the lady from Davie, Representative Howard Rice.
To debate the bill, Mr. Speaker.
The lady has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Folks, when I first was asked to be a co-sponsor of this bill, I'm going to be the first person that tells you that I don't just arbitrarily sign on to bills until I fully understand the impact and the what and the whys about the bill. So I spent many, many hours studying the bill and talking to a lot of folks, and to come to the conclusion that this is a really good bill. And I've had the opportunity over the years to work with a lot of good people on a lot of good ideas, most of them bipartisan bills, but working with the House and the Senate together. I believe that some of the strongest people, members of the Senate and the House, have spent many, many hours working on this. And I will tell you, it's an option. And I continue to say that it's a tool. And if my friend Prior Gibson was here, he would say it's a tool in the toolbox. And this is exactly what this is. The first part of the bill is absolutely the smartest thing that we can do to help the consumers to recapture the cost of the storm damages other than rate increases. That's pretty set and dried. Part two is exactly what Representative Lucas said. It gives you the opportunity to plan for the future opposed to reacting to what's happened in the past. It's a new theory. It's a change, and change is, of course, ever present every day in our life. And if we don't need to have changes, we pretty much stay stagnant and stay the course. But in some cases, we need to have some change, some other avenues to take. I know you need to vote your conscience. There's been a lot of misinformation that has been put out about this bill, but I stand firm. I've had the opportunity over the years to be a part of a lot of major bills that's had impact on the lives of people of the state of North Carolina. And the first question I always ask is, why are we doing this and what does it really do? And in this case, I stand firm that it's a good bill, it's a good proposal, and it is an option. So I ask for your support. Again, I know you need to vote your conscience, but for what it's worth, this is a good bill.
For what purpose, the lady from Mecklenburg, Representative Cunningham Rouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to speak to the bill.
Lady has the floor.
Thank you. In 2013, when I came to the General Assembly, I stood firmly against a lot of issues that were considered not environmentally friendly or consumer friendly. But today, I've had to take another look at things and say, are we trying to punish our industry in the state of North Carolina that has been here for us for generations and generations to come? I, like many of you in this chamber, felt that we should punish that industry. That the punishment for certain things that were done to the environment were and should happen. But you got to take a second look. I hope you all are listening. Take a second look. And the example I'm going to give you is a medical example because I am a nurse by profession. If someone is addicted and it took them 30 years to get messed up, how long you think it's going to take them to get cleaned up or back in the right health from that particular disease process? And most of you probably know what I'm referencing to. I'm talking about coal ash. So we wanted to penalize the industry in my back door. And I did too. But I'm taking a second look. A second look. So we know that even if this bill passes, that it still lies with the North Carolina Utilities Commission for oversight. They still have to go there. This doesn't change that. Doesn't change it at all. With setting the rates that are fair for the consumers, that's what they're charged to do. That's what we put people in position for, to do what the guidelines, to do what the policy said do. And so that's what we charge the Utilities Commission to do. Part two of this bill, technology is quickly changing and is reshaping the way our customers consume energy and electricity and providers do business in North Carolina. This is an opportunity to try something different by exploring alternative options. Duke wants to expand solar. They want to upgrade the grid. They want to withstand cyber attacks. Modern rules, multi-year rate plans are just an example of modern utility options. At least 17 states have implemented MRPs. Virginia, Georgia, and Florida, all in the Southeast. We must allow our industries to move into the 21st century. We cannot continue to lag behind. I ask you to consider how you will vote on this bill and how we will move forward to the 21st century in the state of North Carolina as far as energy. Thank you.
Gentleman from Johnson, Representative Strickland is recognized. Send forth Amendment ARI 37. The clerk will read.
Representative Strickland moves to amend the bill on page 1, line 3 through 5 by rewriting those lines to read.
The gentleman has the floor to debate the amendment.
I would like to first say that my fellow legislator in the Harnett County delegation, first part of this bill I concur with. I think is exactly what we need to do. And I want to try to help with this amendment to make your bill better. And that being rewriting page 1, lines 3 through 5, to require that the Utilities Commission to study the use of multi-rate plan and banding of authorized return mechanics for rate setting for electrical public utilities. And furthermore, on page 15, line 11 through 7, 11, line 11, page 17, line 30, by rewriting these lines to say, part 2, Utilities Commission to study alternative rate setting mechanics. Basically, this is a game-changing situation, I believe, with the electric rates in North Carolina. I believe that it does need all the stakeholders at the table. I believe that we need to have a lot of discussion, and that's why in Section 2 here, it identifies 12 different stakeholders that would work with the staff at the Utilities Commission and come up with a study that within 60 days of the passing of this bill, and a report the findings back to us at a joint legislative commission on energy policy no later than March 1st, 2020. I'm of the opinion that we can not make the same mistake that Virginia made with significant changes to their rate making without stakeholders' input. Customers were overcharged hundreds of millions of dollars. I believe that there's not a whole lot of people that want this bill outside of Duke Energy. And I just put forth this amendment. I think it will help the bill. I think it will open up discussion and stakeholders. And when we come with a study report back to us, we'll have a better situation with the future of electric rates here in North Carolina. I was visiting a country store over the weekend, and of course this is as Representative Lewis said, this is a subject that's way out there, quite a bit of discussion, but I had a gentleman tell me, he said, you know, in a family income monthly budget, you can control your rent or your mortgage, you can control your car payments, you can control to some degree your groceries and the medicine, what medicines you're going to take or not take. But you're at the mercy of the utilities company when you walk to that mailbox, whether it's a farmer in rural North Carolina, whether it's a family, senior citizens, they're at the mercy of that utility when they walk to that mailbox and open that envelope and see what their monthly rate is, electric bill. And I just believe that we need a lot more discussion about bringing the stakeholders to the table. And I believe that making this a study bill, Section 2, will make it a better situation for the future of North Carolina when we're dealing with the electric rates that we'll be paying for in the future. It impacts our industries. It impacts our small businesses, and as I previously said, it affects our residential families throughout the state of North Carolina. So I put forth this amendment in the hopes and the sincerity that it will make this bill better.
For what purpose, gentleman from Cumberland, Representative Soka, rise?
To debate the amendment.
The gentleman has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. First, I'd like to thank all the bill sponsors and the stakeholders who participated in making this bill much better than it was as introduced. However, the bill still has flaws, which lead me to not support the bill as it currently stands. Section 1, as it has been fixed, will save ratepayers money and make it easier for major utilities to recover costs for major storm-related expenses. And I support that. It's good policy not only for ratepayers, but for the utilities. Which brings me to Section 2. The major utilities are absolutely correct. I say that again. The major utilities are absolutely correct in saying that they need new methods for rate making. I agree with them 100%. Our current regulatory structure worked great in the last century when load demand, that is the total demand for electricity, kept increasing year over year. To meet that increasing demand, the utilities needed to build more generation capacity and more infrastructure to deliver electricity to businesses, industries, and residential customers. The compensation model was to ensure a reasonable rate of return based on the utility's capital investments as they added infrastructure. That model, which is still our current regulatory framework, worked well until the mid-70s when we had a major energy crisis. To remind you, that crisis was centered on the oil markets and gas prices in OPEC. It sent shockwaves throughout our country. It was a major contributing factor to our country turning to energy efficiency as a way to reduce costs. As a result of more energy efficiency being introduced across our economy, and think insulation in buildings, better windows, energy efficient appliances, higher miles per gallon requirements for automobiles, LED lights,
to name just a few, the load demand flattened out as we became more energy efficient. As consumers, businesses, and industry use less energy to accomplish the same tasks, we have reduced our need for ever more and more electricity. And we've reduced our need for ever more and more generation. So the old model of compensating utilities for building more and more infrastructure just doesn't work in today's world, and is putting major financial pressure on utilities. In my opinion, we're still using last century's utility model, and it's broken. I get it. I understand where the emphasis for Section 2 is coming from. So the question is, how do we address the reality of this situation? Currently, Section 2 of the bill is one policy among many, many alternative policies that attempts to address this, but it doesn't really solve the underlying problem. The solution in Section 2 is utility-centered, not ratepayer-centered. I certainly don't blame anyone who supports this section for supporting it, but to me it's like putting a Band-Aid on a severed artery. You're doing something, but it just doesn't address the underlying problems. In my opinion, the best alternative for Section 2 is to adopt Representative Strickland's amendment, turn it into a study which will examine not just one policy alternative that, in my opinion, is biased towards utilities, but it will study a variety of policy alternatives that can help us as a state fix our fundamentally flawed regulatory structure and how utilities are compensated that is fair to both utilities and to ratepayers. Please support the amendment and vote green.
For what purpose, gentleman from Harnett, Representative Lewis Rice?
Mr. Speaker, may I ask the gentleman from Johnston a question?
Representative Strickland, does the gentleman yield to Representative Lewis?
Yes, sir.
He yields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Representative. Help me understand why we would study something that is merely giving permissive authority to the experts, the myriad of accountants and lawyers and auditors at the Utilities Commission to determine whether they want to use these tools or not.
I believe working with the staff, these 12 different folks or bodies coming to the table will help formulate an opinion and a policy for the future of North Carolina that will be embraced by its citizens and its workforce and its industry, residential folks. I believe that there's just not been a lot of discussion, in my opinion, with some of the stakeholders, and again, those are those 12 that I've identified in this amendment.
Mr. Speaker, may I debate the amendment?
Just a moment. We're going to set it aside. Just a moment. Take care of the administrative matter. Ratifications, bills, resolutions. Corkery.
The enrolling clerk reports the following bill duly ratified for presentation to the governor. House Bill 370, an act to require compliance with immigration detainers and administrative warrants.
Chapter bills be noted. Chair further directs the bill be enrolled and sent to the governor by special message. Now the gentleman from Harnett, we're going to go back to the bill. Gentleman from Harnett, Representative Lewis, is recognized to debate the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker and members, this bill allows the Utilities Commission to adopt rules and to consider the use of multi-year rate making if they so choose to do so, if it's in the best interest, the least cost to the consumers. This bill requires them, as it's written now, to adopt rules. All of this process involves all of these stakeholders coming to the table. It makes more sense to me that we empower the Utilities Commission to use this authority if they choose it's in the best interest of consumers to do so. And should they choose to use it, they would have to develop this consensus forward-looking plan that would hear from any and every stakeholder that wants to have input on this process. This bill is to allow customer savings, and it would do so by allowing the Utilities Commission, if they choose to make these rules and to put forward this consensus plan. I think that it is redundant, to be the kindest that I can be, to say let's study whether or not the commission would like to have the option to bring together a group of stakeholders and make a forward-looking perspective plan. I think this amendment is very damaging to the bill, and with the utmost respect to the offer of the amendment, I would ask members to vote it down. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
For what purpose, gentleman from Union, Representative R. Price?
To debate the amendment. The
gentleman has the floor.
Thank you, colleagues. I would say that I am against this amendment, particularly because of how it's fashioned. In particular, what we're asking is the Utilities Commission to do a study. And we have listed in Chapter 62-2 10 things that we want the commission to do. And quite frankly, after the end of that, let me just read it to you. It says, to these ends, therefore, the authority shall be vested in the North Carolina Utilities Commission to regulate public utilities generally, their rates, services and operations, and expansion in relation to long-term energy conservation management policies and statewide development requirements in the manner and in accordance with the policy set forth in this chapter. What we see is a confusion of basically checks and balances. It's the job of the Utilities Commission to carry out the policy set by this. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, it's not a good idea to have a study or something like that, but where this is lodged is with the wrong part of government. Theirs is to carry out the policy set forth, not to enact a study about what the policy should be. As Representative Lewis said, they have ample opportunity once the policy is set, if that's applicable, if it's beneficial for ratepayers, and to choose not to do that. But this amendment sets the study in the wrong place of government. The Utility Commission is not set up. They're not tasked to do a legislative-type study of policy. And for that reason alone, I greatly respect my great friend and colleague. I just think that this is wrongly worded and situated, and I ask that you vote against the amendment.
For what purpose, gentleman from Cumberland, Representative Floyd, rise.
To see if Representative Strickland will yield for a question, please.
Gentleman from Johnson, yield the gentleman from Cumberland.
Yes, sir.
He yields.
Yes, sir. Are you on energy and public utilities?
Yes, sir.
Could not.
Jim yield. He yields.
Could not this amendment been ran in utilities?
I guess it was, could have, but it was certainly on the dashboard on July 8th when this bill was on the floor the first time. So it's been out there for, 6 weeks or whatever, and there's been a lot of feedback to me and my folks in my district, and I'm convinced more than ever that this is a good amendment as I stand here today.
Mr. Speaker.
Yes, sir. For the purpose
of speak on the amendment. The
gentleman's recognized to debate the amendment.
Mr. Speaker, you know, we have up here a policy, and this morning I tried to do that with my good friend, Representative Cleveland, is that we try to communicate with the bill sponsors prior to running an amendment to, you know, just get a feel of that amendment prior to. And since the individual, the member, is on utility, I think that that amendment should have been ran in utility because, as you all know, I'm really a time person there. So I can't support this amendment when it had an opportunity to be ran in utility.
Further discussion, further debate on the amendment? If not, the question before the House is the adoption of Amendment A1 sent forward by Representative Strickland. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will open the vote.
Clerk will op machine record the vote. 63 having voted in the affirmative, 50 in the negative. The amendment is adopted. Representative Queen, the chair is in possession of the gentleman's amendment, would rule the amendment is not germane and would specifically say that it does go, because it does really go beyond the scope of the bill. While and by further way of explanation, the previous amendment, Representative Strickland's amendment, while it did amend the title, it was altering a part of the bill that was already there from a policy thing to a study bill. This would be going beyond it. So not trying to stifle the gentleman's right to run an amendment, but respectfully, the chair would rule that the amendment simply does go beyond the scope of the bill.
First of all, I wanted to discuss the bill as amended, as we are at that point of the time now.
We are. Just jump. The chair will return the amendment to the gentleman. The gentleman is recognized to debate the bill on second reading.
Well, let me say this. I offered the amendment in the spirit of the discussion we just had, which is to modernize our rate making, our utility commission, and what we have is a stumbling block in the way of modernizing the utilities commission very mission, which is to be efficient and effective, and without high speed internet serving utilities and utility commissioner customers, you cannot have a modern efficient system. So that's why I offered the amendment. So with all due respect, I would like to appeal the ruling of the chair on that amendment, because it's an essential amendment if we're going to get to a modernized utility commissions implementing a modern utility system. It requires high-speed internet to do that, and we have a stumbling block that just simply needs to be removed so that that can be accomplished. So okay. I wish to appeal the ruling of the chair.
The chair, while the gentleman was recognized to debate on second reading, the chair will go ahead and recognize the appeal of the decision of the chair, and the chair would simply point out as following, just to the base of the chair's ruling. No indication, honestly, from this inference whether the chair disagrees or agrees with the gentleman's intent. But I would ask members who are interested to simply look at the bill in the broader sense of what it addresses. Look at the fact that generally when there's a title change to a bill, that's usually a clue that it goes beyond the scope, but is not always dispositive that it goes beyond the scope of a bill. And I would simply say that that in the opinion of the chair, that this goes into opening into broadband, which this bill did not deal with. Broadband does go beyond the scope of the bill, and for that reason has made the ruling. But the gentleman has noted an appeal. Therefore, at this time, the House will vote on it. The question before the House is, should the members' appeal of the chair's ruling be sustained? All those in favor of the members of appeal and overturning the chair will vote aye. All those opposed to the appeal will vote no. The clerk will open the vote. The clerk will lock machine record the vote. 51 having voted in the affirmative, 63 in the negative. The chair's decision stands. And I believe, and the chair will take a moment just to explain something, because the chair received some questions. Representative Jackson has withdrawn the request to divide the question, but the chair had received a couple of inquiries about what happens if that's done. And the chair would point out, we generally don't do that. Generally we go through the process where an amendment is run, and if an individual wants to withdraw a part of a bill, they run an amendment and withdraw. And I think maybe the gentleman, the provision the gentleman had concerns about probably was what was amended in the first amendment, I'm guessing. And so that resolved the issue. But that's generally been the custom and practice of the House to do that. But the chair had received a couple of inquiries from both sides of the aisle of, well, what happens if the question is divided and one provision passes and the other one fails? What happens in that case, if that happens, is frankly the entire bill fails and the whole bill gets sent back to committee. So that's what happens procedurally when that motion has. I just
thought I would let folks know because I'd received several questions. All right, so we're now back in debate on Senate Bill 559, the chair not being in possession of any other amendments. Further discussion, further debate? If not, the question for the House is the passage of Senate Bill 559 on second reading. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will open the vote. Clerk will lock the machine, record the vote. 110, having voted in the affirmative, 4 in the negative. Senate Bill 559 passes its second reading and will, without objection, be read a third time.
General Assembly of North Carolina annexed.
For what purpose, the gentleman from Wake, Representative John Rice?
I ask that I be recorded as voting aye on the previous vote.
The gentleman will be recorded as having voted aye on the second reading of the bill. Further discussion, further debate? If not, the question for that. Well, I saw the lies. For what purpose, the lady from Pitt, Representative Smith Rice?
To be recorded as an aye on that last vote. Thank you.
It'll be recorded as having voted aye on second reading. Question for the House, passage of Senate Bill 559 on third reading. Those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. Senate Bill 559, having passed third reading, is ordered engrossed and returned to the Senate by special messenger. For what purpose, gentleman from Rowan, Representative Warren Rice?
Mr. Speaker, I was getting water, a drink of water, and you didn't see me motion on the Strickland Amendment. I'd like to be recorded as a no.
The gentleman will be recorded as having voted no on the Strickland Amendment. Representative Lewis, recognize, send forth committee report. Clerk will read.
Representative Lewis, Rules Calling and Operations of the House Committee Report, Senate Bill 250, Records of Excuses for Jury Duty, Favor House Committee Substitute Number 2, Unfavor House Committee Substitute Number 1.
House Committee Substitute Number 1 is placed on the unfavorable calendar. House Committee Substitute Number 2 is counter percent Rule 36B.
Senate Bill 270, Durham Clemens Deannexation, favor House Committee Substitute Number 2, unfavorable committee House Committee Substitute Number 1.
House Committee Substitute Number 1 placed on the unfavorable calendar. House Committee Substitute Number 2 counter percent Rule 36B. Representatives Johnson, Lambeth, Sane, Arp, Brisson, Dobson, Faircloth, McGrady, recognize, send forth committee report. Clerk will read.
Representative Johnson, Lambeth, Sane, Arp, Brisson, Dobson, Faircloth, McGrady, Appropriations Committee Report, House Bill 935, Social Services Reform, Favorable Committee Substitute Number 2, Unfavorable Committee Substitute Number 1, and we refer to Rules, Calendar, and Operations of the House.
Committee Substitute Number 1 is placed on the unfavorable calendar. Committee Substitute Number 2 is referred to the Committee on Rules calendar and Operations of the House. Notices and announcements. For what purpose, gentleman from Columbus, Representative Jones, rise.
Mr. Speaker, having submitted a representative statement with the clerk, I ask that it be read in its entirety upon adjournment spread across the journal and would like to be recognized to speak on the statement.
So ordered, and the gentleman is recognized to speak to a point of personal privilege.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The automotive industry lost a true statesman with the unexpected death of Steve Matthews on August 13, 2019. Steve was a legend in the automotive business. He owned Matthews Motors located in Clayton, Goldsboro, and Wilmington, and was known for the catchy phrase, the walk-in man's friend. He was admired as a business leader and revered for passionately supporting local area businesses for over 25 years. He also gave generously to various organizations and causes throughout the greater Clayton, Gardner, Goldsboro, and Wilmington areas. In addition to his success as a business owner and a philanthropist, Steve was serving as president of the Carolina Independent Auto Dealers Association and was the organizer of the JOCO Teen Drivers, an organization with a goal to reduce teenage driving deaths. Steve received numerous awards and accolades for his deeds over the years. In 2016, he and his wife, Dale, were named Clayton Citizens of the Year, in large part because of their community work with the Clayton Area Ministries, which feeds 700 people every month and provides assistance to area residents with medicine and utility bills. Steve Matthews could always put a smile on everyone's face, and his joy and passion for life were truly contagious. He will be missed, but his legacy will live through his beautiful family, including his wife, Dale, two children, Tyler and Morgan.
For what purpose, John from Brunswick, Representative Isla Rice.
A point of personal privilege.
John's recognized.
Thank you, Ms. Speaker. We had a lot of talk about sheriffs today. I want to mention a couple of sheriffs real quick. On July 30th, our sheriff in Brunswick County, Sheriff John Ingram, was sworn in as president with North Carolina Sheriff's Association. That same evening, the association also recognized our colleague, Representative Carson Smith, as an outstanding retired sheriff. Congratulations to both of these gentlemen.
What purpose, gentleman from Cumberland, Representative Lucas Rice?
Moment of personal privilege.
The gentleman's recognized.
Representative Adler just reminded me, as we talk about sheriffs, I'd like to share with you that recently our Board of County Commissioners saw fit to name the Cumberland County Detention Center after one of our longtime sheriffs, Earl Moose Butler. Congratulations to Mr. Butler.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Catawba, Representative Adams, rise?
Point personal privilege.
No one's recognized.
Just wanted to wish my lovely wife a happy birthday today.
For what purpose does the lady from Mecklenburg, Representative Elk, rise?
For announcement.
Ladies recognized.
I look forward to seeing the Joint Legislative Women's Caucus meeting at 5 o'clock today at the... That's the Greek restaurant. Everyone was asking me. I did the formal name, but it's the one next to the Holiday Inn on Hillsborough Street. And to Representative John and Representative Lewis, this is the Joint Women's Caucus meeting. Thank you.
Bye. For what purpose, gentleman from Rowan, Representative Warren Rice.
Moment of personal privilege.
Gentleman's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just wanted to make my colleagues aware that last Wednesday, the Rowan County Little Girls Little League team won the World Championship in the World Softball Series, World Series. It's the second time they won. They won before in 2015. Just wanted to congratulate them. They've made four trips to Portland to the playoffs, and this is the second time they won the World Championship Series, so kudos to them.
The chair will speak to a very brief moment of personal privilege and would point out that North Carolina this week was the home to the American Legion World Series, actually in Shelby, and there were teams from all over the country. But while they did not win, the Randolph County team made it to the semifinals and represented North Carolina very well. And I can tell you that our county was very proud to host this series. It brings teams from all around the country there, and it was broadcast on one of the ESPN networks. And so I think hopefully North Carolina was represented well. We certainly had a very good barbecue to serve to them while they were there, and we had some good baseball for them to see as well. So for what purpose does the gentleman from Durham, Representative Hawkins, rise?
Point of personal privilege.
The gentleman's recognized to speak to a point of personal privilege.
Colleagues, we have over the last few months in 2019, mourned many who've been lost in mass shootings. But I stand before my colleagues in mourning for two examples of senseless violence that have happened over the last 48 hours in Durham County. One, Khalik Burnett, 18 years old, was shot yesterday and killed. A young life that was lost before school started in Durham County. I am especially sad to hear that, because I have a 17-year-old who will be 18, and I can only imagine what his family is going through. The suspect has been arrested, and so the investigation is continuing on that. The one that should shock everyone, and we want to make sure that we do more for our communities and try our best to curb gun violence and the things that lead to gun violence, is the death of Zion Pearson, a 9-year-old boy. Was shot and killed on Sunday in a Ford Escape vehicle while they were getting ice cream or ices. And so, again, as a dad of three boys, this is especially hurtful to know that a week and a half before school starts, a kid who should have been in the third or fourth grade, now his family is working on funeral arrangements. And so gun violence, no matter how large or how small, impacts our communities every single day. And I want to make sure that you join me and the Durham community and his family in the condolences. Thank you.
For what purpose, gentleman from Harnett, Representative Lewis, rise?
Just an inquiry to the chair.
Gentleman's recognized.
Mr. Speaker, did you say that baseball tournament was in Shelby?
It was in Shelby. That's correct, sir.
Inquiry to the chair.
Gentleman's recognized.
Did they bring the barbecue from Dunn?
I've got a feeling that the hogs probably came from somewhere near Dunn and were brought there, but then they were perfected once they arrived in Cleveland County. So, and we appreciate our friends from Eastern North Carolina from sending us some good pork for us to do great things with once it gets in the West. For what purpose, the gentleman from Cumberland, Representative Floyd, rise?
Inquire the chair.
The gentleman's recognized.
Mr. Speaker, David and Representative Lewis and I, you know, we Google Shelby, and that circle is still turning. Could you give us some assistance?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
No, we Google Shelby. David and I, we Google Shelby, and the circle keep turning on my iPhone. I just wanted to know, could you give us some assistance?
All I know is maybe you need a new phone. I don't know. That's... What have you been watching on that phone, Representative Floyd? Are you having those kind of problems over there? You didn't borrow Representative Pierce's, I hope. Any further notices or announcements? And tomorrow we're going to have a nice early session for you. Jim from Harnett, Representative Lewis, recognized for a motion.
Mr. Speaker, with no need for any more retainers in this chamber, I move that the House adjourn to reconvene Wednesday, August 21st at 8:30 a.m., subject to the standard stipulation set forth in Rule 15.1.
Representative Lewis moves, seconded by Representative Brisson, that the House do now adjourn to reconvene Wednesday, August 21st at 8:30 a.m., subject to the standard stipulation set forth in Rule 15.1. Those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no. Ayes have it. Stand adjourned. Reading of a representative statement, Clerk will read.
A representative statement honoring the life and memory of Steve Matthews, business owner and philanthropist. Whereas the automotive industry lost a true statesman with the unexpected death of Steve Matthews on August 13, 2019. And whereas Mr. Matthews was a legend in automotive business, he owned Matthew Motors located in Clayton, Goldsboro, Wilmington, and known for his catchy phrase, the walking man's friend. And whereas Mr. Matthew was admired as a business leader and revered for passionately supporting local area business for 25 years, he also gave generously to various organizations and causes throughout the greater Clayton, Garner, Goldsboro, and Wilmington areas. And whereas in addition to his success as a business owner and philanthropist, Mr. Matthew served as president of the Carolinas Independent Automotive Dealers Association and was an organizer of the JOCO Teen Drivers, an organization with the goal to reduce teenage driving deaths. And whereas Mr. Matthew received numerous awards and accolades for his good deeds over the years, in 2016, he and his wife, Dale, were named Clayton Citizens of the Year, in large part because of their community work with Clayton Area Ministries, which fed 700 people every month and provided assistance to area's residents with medicine and utility bills. And whereas Mr. Matthews could always put a smile on everyone's face, and his joy and passion for life was truly contagious. He will be missed, but his legacy will live on through this beautiful family, including his wife, Dale, two children, Tyler and Morgan. Now, therefore, Steve Matthews should be remembered as a successful business owner and devoted husband, daughter, father, and true friend. He deserves to be appreciated for his time on this earth because he made it a better place to live. In witness whereof, the undersigned certifies that the following statement was read in the House and placed upon the journal on the 20th day of August 2019, submitted by Representative Brendan Jones, James White, House Principal Clerk.
On motion of the chair appoints conferees. The speaker appoints conferees for Senate Bill 681, short title, Rural Health Care Local Sales Tax Flexibility Utility Accounts. The conferees for that bill are Representative McNeil, Chair, Representative Howard, Hunter, and Hurley. Senate will be notified. And on motion of the chair, Senate Bill 579, short title, Prison Reform Act of 2019. That bill is withdrawn from the Committee on Rules, Counter Operations of the House. The bill is referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, and its serial referral to the Committee on Rules, Counter Operations of the House is added. Special message from the Senate. Clerk will read.
Special message from the Senate. Mr. Speaker, it is ordered that the message be sent to the House of Representatives with the information that the Senate adopts a report of the conference for Hospital 99 Conference Committee to substitute a bill to be entitled an act to establish alcohol law enforcement as a separate division of the Department of Public Safety and to clarify the jurisdiction and primary responsibilities of the Alcohol Law Enforcement Agency, and also move the Boxing Advisory Commission to the Department of Commerce and rename it the Boxing Commission, and to give it rulemaking authority. When the appropriate action has been taken by both chambers, the bill will be ordered and rolled. Respectfully, Sarah Holland, Principal Clerk.
The appropriate action has been taken by both chambers. House Bill 99 will be ordered and rolled and sent to the governor. Special message from the Senate. Senate Chamber, August 20th, 2019. Mr. Speaker, pursuant to your message received today that the House of Representatives failed to concur in House Bill 126, Senate Committee Substitute No. 2, 4th Edition, a bill to be entitled an act to amend Certificate of Need laws, the President temporarily appoints Senator Brown Chair, Senator Harrington, Senator B. Jackson on the part of the Senate to confer with a light committee appointed by your honorable body to the end that the differences arising may be resolved. Respectfully, Sarah Holland, Principal Clerk of the Senate. That message is noted. Special message from the Senate. Senate Chamber, August 20th, 2019. Mr. Speaker, pursuant to your message received today that the House of Representatives failed to concur in House Bill 226, Senate Committee Substitute No. 2, 6th Edition, a bill to be entitled an act to make various changes and technical corrections to the laws governing the administration of justice, the President peremptorily appoints Senator Brown Chair, Senator Harrington, Senator B. Jackson on part of the Senate to confer with the light committee appointed by your honorable body to the end that the differences arising may be resolved. Respectfully, Sarah Holland, Principal Clerk of the Senate. That message is noted. Special message from the Senate. Mr. Speaker, it is ordered the message be sent to the House of Representatives with information that the Senate failed to concur in Senate Bill 361, House Committee Substitute No. 2, 6th Edition, a bill to be entitled an act to enact the Physiological Interjurisdictional Compact, allow licensed marriage and family therapists to conduct first-level commitment examinations, eliminate redundancy in adult care and home inspections, raise awareness of lupus, and create the Lupus Advisory Council, ensure the proper administration of step therapy protocols, ensure equal coverage for oral cancer drugs, modernize Medicaid telemedicine policies, increase access to telehealth services, and create North Carolina Health Solutions Task Force. Respectfully, Sarah Holland, Principal Clerk of the Senate. That message is noted. Special message from the Senate, Senate Chamber, August 20th, 2019. Mr. Speaker, pursuant to your message received today that the House of Representatives failed to concur in House Bill 777, Senate Committee Substitute 3rd Edition, a bill to be entitled an act to amend the laws governing the purchase of admitted membership services for teachers and state employees, retirement systems, and local government employees, retirement systems to make changes to the unclaimed property statutes to require stress testing for the teachers and state employees' retirement system as recommended by the Pew Foundation to make technical corrections and laws pertaining to the teachers and state employees' retirement system, the local government employees' retirement system, the consolidation and judicial retirement system, the North Carolina National Guard Pension Fund, the North Carolina Public School Teachers Professional Educators and Investment Plan, and the North Carolina State Health Plan for Teachers and State Employees to improve viability of water and wastewater systems of certain units of local government by requiring local government commission approval to grant applications to require certain water and wastewater systems to undergo a review of infrastructure management, organizational management, and financial management to create the viable utility reserve to provide grant money for local government units to provide the statutory process for merger and dissolution of water and wastewater systems established under Chapter 162A of General Statutes to promote the importance of interlocal agreements to the operation of water and wastewater systems and to study sub-basin transfers and historical charters. The President temporarily appoints Senator Brown Chair, Senator Harrington, Senator B. Jackson on part of the Senate to confer with the light committee appointed by your honorable body to the end that the differences arising may be resolved. That message is noted. Senate Bill 562, on motion of the Chair, Short title, the Second Chance Act. That bill is withdrawn from the calendar, 36B, recommitted to the Committee on Rules, Calendar Operations of the House. And subsequently, that bill is withdrawn from the Committee on Rules, Calendar Operations of the House, and recommitted to the calendar pursuant to Rule 36B. Representative Lewis is recognized to send forth a Rules, Calendar, and Operations of the House Committee report. Senate Bill 682, Implement Crime Victim Rights Amendment, Favorable House Committee Sub Number 2, Unfavorable House Committee Sub Number 1, House Committee Sub Number 1 placed on the unfavorable calendar, whereas House Committee Substitute Number 2 for Senate Bill 682 will be placed on the calendar pursuant to Rule 36B for August 21st. Representative Lewis is recognized to send forth a committee report for the Rules, Calendar, and Operations of the House Committee. Senate Bill 315, North Carolina Farm Act of 2019, Favorable House Committee Sub Number 4, Unfavorable House Committee Sub Number 3. House Committee Sub Number 3 will be placed on the unfavorable calendar, whereas House Committee Substitute Number 4 for Senate Bill 315 will be calendar pursuant to Rule 36B for August 21st.